Bulls Mania is over. No more underdogs. All the home teams were in command this weekend. We're breaking down everything that happened in the four games. Plus, offseason look ahead for the Eagles, including Foles' future, the Cowboys, and their many upcoming decisions, as well as the cap-rich Colts and Chargers. It's all on the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Monday Morning Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We are coming off the games that precede the conference finals, which are, of course, the conference semifinal games. We had four of them this weekend. Ended with a real good one, even if the first three were a bit of snoozers. But we're going to talk about those games. We're going to talk about the offseason look-aheads for the teams that were eliminated this weekend. And we are going to have a great show.
Well, I hope so, because this divisional round, you know, we're going to talk, I assume we're opening with Saints and Eagles, because that was by far the best game. And then the other three games, we basically can sum up great team played good team, and great team beat the crap out of good team.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot in the upset department here. This Eagles game, and we're going to go backwards chronologically here. We're going to start with the last game of the weekend, which was the Saints' victory over the Eagles, and then we'll work back. But started with the Saints game. This was like a reverse Nick Foles game. The Eagles ended it shaky, and they started it with a flourish. And you know, it wasn't enough on the road, as well as this early game went for them, and as impressive as this run has been for them over the last couple of years, it's over. They were just not the better team.
No, they weren't. And even though the Eagles led early, and the early lead got your attention if you're a Saints fan, no mm-hmm. question about that. But once the Saints got rolling, they got a real feel for Philadelphia's cover three. And as we suspected, Gary, the Eagles stayed in cover three all game. They did not go to the man-to-man stuff that they did back in week 11 at New Orleans. So, yeah, once the Saints got a feel for that, the Saints were in such command of the game, it almost felt like they were blowing out the Eagles in the second half. And when Philly was driving down six, I was a little bit out of my body experience thinking, man, there's no way the Eagles can win this game, because it just felt so, even though this one was close, this felt like the fourth blowout to me. I thought the Saints were clearly the best team, and it was evident on both sides of the ball.
Well, look, they had that 18-play, 92-yard drive that took up 11.5 minutes in the third quarter. And a lot of that was, the pattern was, put Taysom Hill on the field, pick up holding penalty and get backed up, and then just pick up the first down. That happened at least twice, maybe three times. I don't think it was a Taysom Hill play, but another time where they picked up a penalty and were behind the sticks, and then they just they went and got it. And that just felt like a drive that, if the field was 300 yards long, that was going to be a touchdown drive.
Yeah, they were just going to expire the game if it was 300 yards long. They were just in total command. You know, the only thing that was real negative that stood out, and I think what contributed to the way that drive unfolded, is Drew Brees does not have much juice on vertical throws anymore. He can't push it. That's why we thought the Eagles might keep their free safety down shallow, make the Saints beat him over the top, and we saw right away Brees can't beat you over the top. And LeBlanc, who had an excellent night, had that interception to open the game. But they still got the feel for what Philadelphia was doing, and they were glad to work the underneath and intermediate games. They're real lucky they have Michael Thomas, too, aren't they, Gary? That guy can move the chains as well as any receiver I've seen.
Absolutely. And look, when you think about it, yes, Alvin Kamara is very talented as a receiver. I mean, Michael Thomas is the way they scheme him open and the way he gets open constantly is pretty exceptional. Considering they really don't have anyone else who you would even consider devoting a second defender to.
Yeah, he's really good at what they call stemming your route. The initial steps in your route, that's your stem. That's a big deal for how you set up defenders. His, what was it, third down and 16, I think it was, third and something like that, where he had the 20-yard catch. It was at the end of that drive you talked about. And by the way, that 92-yard drive, they gained 112 yards on the drive because of all the penalties. I wonder how many 100-plus yard drives we've had in the NFL postseason history. Yeah. But that in-breaking route, which he killed him on all night long, to cap at the near the end of that drive, was really illustrative of what Thomas brings to the table and why he's so good. He set up his defender. He sets up his defenders exceptionally well. And the other thing the Saints do is they leverage the underneath defenders with Thomas and Kamara at times. So Thomas's route will impact the linebackers, and then Kamara runs underneath them, or sometimes it works vice versa. They're very good at doing that, and obviously Breeze is good at reading that. And if you're going to be predictable like Philadelphia was, then your pass rush has to get home and change the makeup and the landscape of the game that way. And the Eagles' pass rush, aside from a few flashes tonight, it really didn't do that. That's a good Saints offensive line.
Yeah, and of course, last time they met was when the Eagles played a little bit of man. They doubled Michael Thomas and Alvin Kamara, and you had Traquan Smith at a 10-catch, 157-yard game in that one. And this one was closer. So I guess the Eagles, you would say the adjustment was correct from a global standpoint on that. This Eagles team, they came out fast. I was kind of hoping we'd see a lot more. I don't know exactly what the splits ended up being. I thought it was a Golden Tate type of game. If you're going to bring in Golden Tate, I think PJ Williams is the guy you go after in that Saints secondary. You want him on the field, and they did. They got him on that Jordan Matthews touchdown to start the game, but. Yeah, I don't know. They had no semblance of an offense between their opening two touchdown drives and then really that final drive that, of course, ended with the ball slipping through Alshon Jeffrey's hands and into Marshawn Lattimore's stomach.
Yeah, this is what we were talking about when we said that the Eagles do not match up as well to the Saints as they did to the Bears, even though the Bears were the better defense. The Bears are a zone defense, and the Saints really, it felt like this game, we need to see the all 22, but it felt like there was a lot of matchup elements, a lot of man-to-man or coverages that played out like man-to-man. Lattimore traveled with Jeffrey all night long. It wasn't just the second half. He traveled with him in the first half as well. He had some great snaps with him in the second half. But there was a real active energy and assertiveness to the way the Saints were playing coverage on the back end. And Foles, quite frankly, Gary, who I have come to really admire with how good he is at throwing with bodies around him, he was not very accurate in the second half. He wasn't the same thrower in quarters 3 and 4.
Yeah, the Eagles just look disjointed overall. Charles Davis had made the point a couple times during the telecast. Saints were getting up and disrupting these routes early on.
They did not do early, by the way. Yes. Remember, Eli Apple got caught playing off on one of those Golden Tate catches early in the game, the slot route, out route for 12 yards. So, yeah, that press coverage is a big deal. Philly's not very fast. You can press those wide receivers. You're not going to get beat over the top by them.
This got real hairy at the end. It just, yeah. I don't know. It was fun to imagine what was going to happen there. Second and 10, they have the ball on the Saints 27 with 2 minutes to go. But that's it. I mean, hey, a break goes against Nick Foles here, and the Saints move on. And, you know, if they started this game, if they needed to knock a little bit of rust off early on, and that's what attributed to the slow start after basically the two-week bye, they got it out of the way now. And now they host the Rams next week in another rematch. Two rematches of really good games coming up next
week. I know, and not just good games, mid-season games, which means these teams have evolved a little bit in some subtle ways since when they last met. This is as intriguing of a championship round as you can get. Top four offense is still standing, too, by the way.
Yeah, that was a bit of a theme as we'll go through the show. Everyone was kind of thinking, well, is this offense crazy season going to end with defenses ruling? It did not.
Nope.
Spoiler,
nope.
If you missed the games this weekend, that's not how it went down. Let's before we move on to the next game, let's just talk about the Eagles offseason look at it real quick. And really, I mean, look, Nick Foles. Nick Foles has a mutual option. The assumption is that he will move on, and you'd have to think one of these teams looking for a starter short term is going to pick up Nick Foles. And I guess my question to you, Andy, is how much would you trust him as sort of a long-term guy? I mean, would you look at him? It's a not very good draft class coming out for quarterbacks. And, you know, there are probably five or six teams who could use a guy for the next, say, at least 3 to 5 years.
Perhaps. I think it's what this is just a king-sized Case Keenum situation. And what we saw last year, and maybe Foles gets a deal similar to Keenum's with a little bit better money, and it's probably a team like Denver, might even be Denver, who knows, but a team that's on that 8-8 cusp but thinks they might be pretty good on one side of the ball, that's who would take the chance on Nick Foles. The other thing to consider, Gary, is there's nothing wrong. I mean, there's something wrong, but it's not. There's no shame in being one of the greatest backups of all time, which might be what Foles still is. And I'm sure someone will give him a chance as a starter, but if he doesn't do well next season, his value then becomes as a journeyman backup in the best of ways, which, again, that might be what he already is.
Yeah. Oh, that was a lot of fun. that Foles thing was fun while it lasted, and let's see what happens going forward here. Would you give him, if I threw out like 3 years, $57 million, or maybe 2 years and the third year is kind of like an option, would you do it?
How's my cap situation otherwise? I mean, am I comfortable even after the deal?
It's fine because you're not paying a quarterback.
I'd probably do it. Obviously, it depends who I have around me, but I'd probably do it. I would have to have a system that gets the ball out quickly.
Yeah.
Because Foles, for the long, he's always going to be a physically methodical player. That's just the way he's constructed. But he's no longer, early in his career, he was also mentally methodical at times. He's no longer like that. He now thinks the game quickly, and so he plays quicker than he appears to play, and that's why he's so hard to sack. So if I had a system that was conducive to that, and Philadelphia's is conducive to that, obviously, if I believed my coach could do that, I would pay Nick Foles. But I've got to have a good team around. I'm not paying him just to get me to 7-9. I'm paying Nick Foles to get me to 10-6, and that maybe I can ride a defense or something once we reach the postseason. It's that kind of team. That's why I think a Denver type of team is what would make the most sense for Nick Foles.
All right. Real quick note before we move on. Andy and I have three more coach hirings to go. We talked about a bunch of them on the Thursday Deep Dive show last week. You can just go to the end of that show and listen to them instead of re-listening to the preview of these games. But Adam Gase, Zach Taylor, and Brian Flores, the latter two are reported. They're not official yet, but we will talk about those hirings on the Thursday Deep Dive show because we only have two games to go here. So coaches will also have a slightly bigger mailbag than we usually do on Thursday. So send those questions in talkback@themqb.com. You can tweet them to us. You can Facebook them to us. You can mail them to us. Just get them to us. We'll take plenty of questions. Patriots, Chargers. Look, this was... We had talked about, do you keep seven defensive backs on the field? Do you play your not very good linebackers? There really was no good answer for the Chargers. I know a lot of people are out there saying, oh, I can't believe they kept on playing the seven defensive backs. And I haven't seen the exact split, so I'm sort of going anecdotally off of I tried to keep an eye out for when Kyle Emanuel and or Hayes Pullard was on the field for the Chargers, but they kind of get, I mean, they got steamrolled when they had five defensive backs and those two linebackers on. So I think this was just not, it was just not going to happen today.
Yeah, correct. It was not going to happen. The Chargers, they had those two linebackers on the field at times when New England was in two tight ends with Dwayne Allen, one of the tight ends. He's their run blocker, of course. Gronkowski was phenomenal run blocking today. So that was they treated that as base. When the Patriots went to 21 with Devlin on the field, there were snaps, a lot of snaps, where the Chargers stayed in their dime, which we thought maybe they might do. Remember that, Gary? We talked about, I might keep Adrian Phillips in, but I'm not keeping the 7th DB in. You got to have Emmanuel out there and at least have some girth. None of it mattered. The Patriots steamrolled them anyway. The Patriots O-line was winning. Devlin continued to look good as a fullback. But the part of this whole equation that we forgot, we got so caught up in the Chargers, say, 7 DBs, hey, you run the ball on them. we forgot New England's also very good at throwing the ball, and Tom Brady's good at throwing the ball, and these guys are well coached, and the scheme is good, and you're a predictable defense, especially when you're in 7DB. You're not going to be doing a lot of new stuff when you're playing safeties at linebacker spots. You're going to be doing the basic stuff because that's how you can cross-pollinate at your positions like that. Well, predictable zone coverage against Tom Brady. We've seen that before, especially in the playoffs. Ask the Steelers a few years ago how that goes. That, to me, was what decided this game, is New England came out in 11 personnel, one back, one tight end, three wide receivers, and they did whatever they wanted through the air.
They did. And look, this was not downfield stuff. I mean, this was a ton of James White, a ton of Julian Edelman, and it was just a defense that could not get off the field at any point. Patriots end up going only 7 for 14 on third down. It felt like a lot more, but 498 yards, 155 of them on the ground, 343 through the air. Yeah, this was a shellacking here for the most part. And now I guess let's talk about the other side of the ball briefly here, which kind of goes into next week when the Patriots go to Arrowhead to play the Chiefs. But a lot of zero blitz looks from the Patriots, or certainly yes, a lot more than you would have expected from this defense.
Well, we said on that Thursday show, what you want to do is get Phillip Rivers going late into the play clock when he starts getting antsy and clapping his hands and mm-hmm. barking out there. And they had a couple of delay of games. They had to burn some timeouts. New England was getting them to do that by showing those amoeba looks, the same thing the Ravens did to the Chargers. The Patriots have done that before. They're not quite the Ravens in terms of aggressiveness, even when it comes to just the pre-snap phase, but they make you play that way. They make you have to read their fronts and make some decisions. What was different, you said it, Gary, they brought the pressure this time, and they did go cover zero. They did it early in the game, which I think was partly to get Rivers to speed up mentally and start accounting for that and thinking they might be coming. You want Rivers to play fast. What the Patriots do when they go cover zero, they almost always drop one guy from the middle out late, and usually it's Kyle Van Noy. So it's a cover zero blitz until your protection occurs and you start blocking people, then somebody peels back. And the reason they do that is because most teams will throw hot against cover zeros, little short slant routes. Well, you take those away, and so now it's cover zero, and you're forcing the offense to throw the ball downfield. And that's what the Patriots did. Rivers targeted Mike Williams. That's his big target. Throw it up to that guy. And it did not work. The Patriots won. The coverage won. The defensive pressure won.
Yeah, that first Chargers touchdown that tied the game at 7 early. Shades of early last year where the Patriots had some issues on the back end. I guess that was less a miscommunication, and it seemed more Stephon Gilmore looked like he recognized something on that play, and then it was a double move, and that was that was it. But that, I think that was, even after that touchdown, it was kind of like, all right, well, if they score on every drive, they'll hang around today.
Yeah, because it did feel early on like, oh, they're not going to – New England's going to do what they want. They're not going to stop New England. Now, maybe they can get some field goals, force them to some field goals in the red zone, which they didn't do that either. But, yeah, this was a Patriots game all the way. I want to ask you something before we get off these Sunday games and onto the Saturday games, because you watched these games late today, as I understand it, correct? And did you have,
yes,
like, a little boy's birthday party that you had to attend to? I want to know what your day was scheduled like.
Specifically my son's. I didn't just attend a random child's birthday party, although that would be a pretty good weekend. I will say this, Andy. The venue we had it at was this indoor soccer place he has been going to. So he's a toddler. He's 3 years old. That's where he wanted to do it. They have like a playscape there, and it was a fun party. But they had a TV there. One of the dads wanted to watch the game, so the game was on the TV. I asked them, could they mute it? And the guy, you know, the guy, he was probably like 18 years old, but the young man, very nice young man, said, we can't. It whatever's on the TV comes through the speakers. So I kind of tried to be among the kids, the screaming kids, as much as possible to drown out Kevin Burkhart and Charles Davis during the late game. And then it was...
No offense to those guys. They are very good, by the way, as it
They were very... we had opposite the TV, there's a, it's like all giant window. So then you also had the reflection in the window of the TV. So basically I had to discipline myself for 2 hours. I did not lift my eye level above, like, you know, basically what's eye level for me, like, you know, if I'm 5'9", so I did not look up at all, and I managed to avoid anything. It was during the late game, though I didn't hear a lot of crowd noise, so I kind of had a feeling when I turned on the game tonight that the Eagles stuck around early.
Okay, well, that's
it.
That's, this gets into a fascinating discussion on spoilers and all the ways it can happen. It's not just hearing the score, because you and myself, we watch so much football all year long. Any kind of information provides a flood of other information that serves to spoil. So your point about the crowd noise, you're just an astute football observer. That's what happens. I, as you know, watch these on DVR, and so I went for a run tonight in the hills by my house during the Saints-Eagles game, and I feel pretty confident doing that. You're not going to get a lot of people out there out in the middle of these western trees. Think of Breaking Bad, the scenery there. That's kind of what it's like where we live. It's not quite that deserty, but it's I'm out west here. You're not going to get someone on those trails going 45-12, the Eagles are up or something like that. It's not so. But I went to the gym yesterday during the first game, and it's the only time I've worn headphones at the gym. I went in and I kept my eyes down because I know the exercise bikes have TVs on them. That's the risk. I wanted to lift some weights. But a few years ago on the Ravens Texans playoff game, so this was, I mean, this was several years ago now, but I was in the gym when they were playing. I was risking going. I was not sure I should risk it. I'm doing my crunches in the little mat, tiny dark mat room where there's nothing in there. And some guy walks by and says, "Chris, 13-10. And I said every little cuss word in my head that I could think of. And I invented some even that day. Well, when I got back home, so I'm watching, I'm thinking, I just hope they get to 13-10 as soon as possible. Because what happens, and it's all you do is watch a game thinking, how's it going to be 13? How's it going to be 10? What's about to happen? Well, it turns out the guy that was walking down the hall, I guess he was saying the score to like a pickup game that was going on in the basketball gym or something, because the game never got to 13-10. It wasn't the Texans Ravens game, but it didn't matter because I believed it was going to be 13-10, and so I still watched the game through that tinted view.
Yeah.
And that ruins the game. So, like, Robert Klemko on our staff, who likes to send false spoilers, you know, Seahawks won when actually the Niners won, and he thinks he's being funny, and then when the Niners win, he says, "Well, I didn't spoil it. I told you it was the Seahawks." It does any kind of information ruins the viewing experience. That's the big takeaway. So you've got to hear nothing when you put these games on DVR.
Because if you think you know a score, you think you know a result. I mean, if you know the result of the game, it's ruined. But if you think you know a score, you're kind of just eager to get to the point where it is that score, and then you say, like, okay, now I'm watching with fresh eyes.
Correct. And if I'm going to watch these games on TV, because you don't see as much on TV. So if I'm watching them, I want to not know the score, because you do get a different feel for the game when you don't know the score. That's the one thing about watching film is you do know the outcome. So you don't have any of that momentum or cliffhanger stuff, and it does feel different. That's why I like watching college film in the off season, like the Stanford North Carolina Sun Bowl a few years ago. I was watching I did something with Trubisky and with Solomon Thomas. I watched that game a few times. I didn't know who won. So at the end of the film study, I was on the edge of my seat because that went down into the tight red zone. And actually, Solomon Thomas sacked Mitchell Trubisky, if I recall correctly. So that was the best game I ever saw in film because I didn't know what happened in it.
That was a good game. But yeah, I don't recommend anyone watch football Andy Benoit style. I did it for a day. That was enough.
Now, last question, then we'll get on to what people are actually listening to this show for, which is analysis, those who are left, is did you fast-forward the special teams?
I did.
Ha-ha!
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I watched any of them.
You felt like you gained, didn't you? You felt smart.
A little bit, I guess. Not really, though. When I saw, I don't know, I was like, do I want to miss Kamara returning kicks here? I just went ahead and did it.
Nothing makes you feel smarter than fast-forwarding special teams, seeing a long return, and then seeing the little yellow flag sign come up, and the upper corner, and then you think, yep, that's right. Every time it's like anything good on special teams comes back on penalty. That's the main reason I don't watch it.
I regret admitting that.
Yeah, you're coming over.
I shouldn't have. Quick look at for the Chargers. This is actually, I mean, this is fairly simple. I don't think they really, you know, they want to address their interior offensive line, I would assume. I don't think you can really trust Forrest Lamp at this point with the injuries issues he's had the last couple of years. And I don't know, I guess depth at linebacker, but I don't know if they're necessarily not deep at linebacker. Denzel Perryman's a free agent. But they don't have a whole lot of guys they have to move on here.
They don't. They've got some D tackles they need to re-sign. Damian Square, their backup. Darius Filon, another really good backup. And then Brandon Mebane, who played today, and that was admirable of him. Those guys are all going to be free agents. So if you're not going to retain them, then that's probably where you're drafting. Adrian Phillips, also a free agent. I assume he'll be a priority to re-sign. If you lose him, now you got to find a new dime linebacker. And look, maybe they'll find somebody. Adrian Phillips, he's a good player, but teams went after him a little bit late this year. And New England had some play-action over routes that attacked him by design, and they worked. So I don't know. Maybe they'd be fine replacing him, because the whole reason he's in there is to defend play-action. That's the main benefit of having a safety down at linebacker. And Phillips down the stretch this year, he was great most of the time. In fact, he was really great last week. That was a big deal against Baltimore. But he had 5 or 6 slip-ups as well that he paid a price for. So it'd be interesting to see if they deem that a successful campaign or not for him, what the expectations are there.
Yeah, I'll just say they don't necessarily need Tyrell Williams. I'm sure they'd love to have him back, but he'd be interesting. He's always been a very impressive physical specimen who sort of came into his own a little bit, and he is an unrestricted free agent. So we'll see what his situation is. But let's go back to Saturday night, the Rams-Cowboys game. And look, the story of this game, I wondered this aloud when we did the Thursday show. That Rams offensive line, would they be up to the task after a shaky run late in the season? And then kind of, you know, Cardinals 49ers game, no one really gets too worked up about the performances there. But they were dominant in this game. I mean, they that's where they beat the Cowboys, and that's why this offense felt like the Rams offense of like September and October.
It's a great performance. And something, did you see what Austin Blythe said after the game, their right guard for the Rams?
I saw Robert Klemko wrote about it. I was technically on vacation this week, but I did watch the games. And now I'm back
here. Oh, wow, vacation. The divisional round, interesting timing. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Some might question
I was on vacation. I was on vacation, yet I wrote a column, I edited 2 pieces, and now I'm doing the podcast. But I saw Robert wrote a piece on it. I did not see the specific quotes though.
Well, I guess what Blythe said, I didn't either, but I've heard Reed Foster pointed this out, one of our research interns. I guess Blythe said that they had a feel. They knew what was coming from Dallas's defensive line slants, which is the whole foundation of Dallas's D. He said they knew on about 90% of them what was coming because they had all kinds of tips and tells. That's coaching right there. That's the Aaron Cromer effect. He's the Rams' O-line coach. Shane Waldron's their run game coordinator. He probably had something to do with it. And I bet you anything, Sean McVay had something to do with it, because one of these things that these assistants marvel at with McVay is how he picks up on the type of details that only a position coach is expected to pick up on.
This was a great night for the Rams. I don't know how else to sum it up. I mean, this looked like the team that they were in September when everyone thought they might run the table.
Well, and their O-line never became an issue in pass protection because their success through the air came on first and second down. The Rams run all that outside zone stuff, and those are such slower developing play actions as well that by the time Goff turns around ready to throw, his receivers are well downfield. That's why Brandon Cooks is valuable in that scheme, because Cooks can get to that 18-yard depth really quickly. Robert Woods is efficient on routes. This is also why they run out of those tight formations, because because those receivers can then get on their crossing routes further downfield if they're beginning the route tighter inside rather than having to cross the entire field. So it's a deeper play action game than most teams run because it's a slower play action game early on in the fake handoff part.
That's a good point. And it is just phenomenal watching the way after the fake, Goff's back foot hits, and it's almost like it's almost amazing. It's like he doesn't have time to actually recognize anything downfield. He just knows he knows where everything's going to be, and the ball is just out immediately.
Yeah, maybe they're cheating there, and that helmet's still on, and someone in the booth overhead or McVay on the side. Maybe they're telling. You know, they were going to experiment with that in the Canadian Football League. I heard. I think it was the Canadian Football League, having the helmet communication there all the time. But
open all the time.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. Goff is, when he knows and trusts the design, he always knows the design, but when he trusts that it will work, he's just about as good as anybody in the NFL at anticipation passing. It's when he has to read stuff and make, let's call it off-schedule decisions or plan B decisions, that's where he becomes inconsistent. Because he's a great passer, but he's a little bit mechanical as a passer. He's got a longer delivery, and so he's not quick and twitchy. So he's going to be a little bit more inconsistent because the longer it takes you to throw, the more chance there is of something going wrong when you're throwing. But when he's able to throw on schedule, he is really, really, really good.
And C.J. Anderson, nice to have fresh legs this time of year. Todd Gurley looked perfectly healthy, although it might have been spelled more often than he normally would have because of the layoff. But, yeah, there you go. Rams look good. Cowboys, I mean, if the Cowboys were going to run into an elite team, I think we can agree that the Cowboys are probably on that second tier, and they're probably not going to win a postseason game against a team that is playing like the Rams played on Saturday night. But I don't know. This game did not I know it was a one possession game in the end. It did not feel that close at any point.
No, it didn't. And the last note, I know we haven't talked Dallas's offense here, but really they run through Ezekiel Elliott, and the Rams were just good enough in run defense. In fact, they're better than just good enough. They played very well, and it's interesting because I think Wade Phillips believes that they can do that when they put their mind to it. They can be a run-defending team, and so far it looks like he's right about that. The last interesting note, though, of this game is when Dallas was down one possession, and it's late in the game, and it's a crucial drive, and they know the Rams are running the ball. It was Sean Lee on the field, not Leighton Vander Esch, and that makes you wonder. We saw Chris Richard chewing out Vander Esch on the sidelines there. It wasn't just Vander Esch, but that was a big part of it. Makes you wonder if maybe that was some of the issue that the young rookie, we said, I think McVay is going to go after those young linebackers. Mm-hmm. And I think he got them that night. I think the Cowboys played slow and were not quite ready for all the subtle things they were going to have to see at the linebacker position.
It was a tough Saturday for great young linebackers. It was
Darius Leonard transition coming up, I sense.
Very soon. Not quite, because we do have to do the Cowboys look ahead, but it was great coaches seeing great young linebackers and saying, we can get these guys, and they did. Quick Cowboys look ahead here. It's interesting. They in the past couple years had a lot of dead money on their cap. Almost all of that is off at this point, so they do have a little more cap room than they've had in the past. They have a decision to make on Sean Lee. I would assume they move on. They can save $7 million by moving on. I think as wonderful as he's been and as great as it would be to have him as a mentor slash insurance policy, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to pay him $10 million to keep him in here. What's interesting about this team, though, is so you have DeMarcus Lawrence in free agency this year. He played on the tag this year. Extensions possible for Dak Prescott, Jalen Smith, Amari Cooper, Byron Jones, and Lyle Collins, among others. So decisions to make here.
Big decisions to make. And I think all of those guys, you're going to want to have them back, aren't you? I mean, those are some big names that you just put out there. That's the plus side of drafting well, I suppose, is you have to make those decisions on extensions. But Prescott will be the interesting one, of course, and I would kick that can down the road as much as I can. We can have that discussion 100 times after
we
the
will
season,
have it,
right?
We will have it a lot. We will. You and I will try to structure a contract here for Dak Prescott. We'll talk about it a ton. I still think there is enough of a sort of residual, market popularity sort of advantage for Dak Prescott where they can get him on a fairly team-friendly deal. Not a totally team-friendly deal, but a fairly team-friendly deal that sort of makes it easier to stomach this. Because look, he's a guy, he's been a great asset as a guy making like $600,000, and it all becomes different when that number goes into the, 20 million or whatever it'll be. Let's go to Chiefs Colts for now, though. Chiefs jumped on him early. I mean, this was everything we thought was wrong with the Chiefs defensively. This was a complete domination, and everything we thought would go well for the Colts defensively did not go well. I'll just mention early on because the Colts, the way they started this game offensively, it kind of reminded me of when they won in Houston a couple weeks ago. They went three and out to start because he had an Eric Ebron drop on a short third down. And a couple weeks ago in Houston, they just turned it on, and they just started throwing it all over the place on a secondary that wasn't very good. And I was kind of waiting for that to click, and maybe it felt a little bit like it at the end of the second, or excuse me, at the end of the first half. But after that, I mean, they did nothing. I mean, this was a very good performance by this Chiefs defense.
Yeah, that's the problem. Because I picked the Colts to win this game. I did not know the Chiefs defense would all of a sudden become the 2000 Baltimore Ravens, where you just don't do anything against them, and it's just three and out, three and out, three and out, three and out. And with 1:40 left in the first half, the Colts had run 12 plays, zero first downs, 21 yards. They were down 24 to 7. The amazing part, they were only down 17 at that point.
Yeah.
But that's with 1:40 to go in the half. Now, some of that is their own defense was not getting off the field. Patrick Mahomes was doing what he wanted. The Chiefs were running the ball very well. Damian Williams, another fresh legs guy to add to your theory, Gary, which I fully back. Fresh legs from a tailback late in the year is a big deal. So the Colts couldn't get off the field. Their offense couldn't stay rhythmic because they had no chance to be on the field. And that's kind of how this went. What gets lost in it all is in the second half, Indianapolis' defense, you could say, it certainly kept the Chiefs in check. You could say they maybe even outplayed the Chiefs, but it didn't matter because that Kansas City defense, they were world beaters on Saturday. Where did that
come from?
I had no, and I'll be honest, because I don't look at home field and the road stuff a whole lot. It's just not how I see football. I know it's a factor. I didn't realize Kansas City's defense was so much better at home than they were on the road. I didn't know that. And a lot, they're not the only team that's like that this year. The Patriots have been a lot better at home than on the road too.
Yeah, they've definitely been much better at home. The one thing, as this game was getting underway, and the snow had fallen, and it kind of obviously tapered off as the game went on, but the sloppy field, you would figure, really the only thing the Chiefs have going for them defensively is those edge rushers, and if they're a step slow because of the sloppy track, it seemed like it was going to be a long day for them, and it was the opposite. I mean, Dee Ford, it was the way this game started and the way the Saints game started with Crevon LeBlanc making a really great interception where you kind of said, well, that's supposed to be the weakness, and he made a play right off the bat. And Chiefs kind of started the same way here with, running the ball right at Dee Ford, and he comes in and makes a play for a three-yard loss.
And then on the next play, it was Marlon Mack on the outside as a toss play. And he cut it up way too soon. And he looked methodical, and he didn't use his block the right way. And it did not look like a Marlon Mack run. Marlon Mack is one of the NFL's better pure runners, in my opinion. So I wrote in my notes, I had light, snowy conditions as going into the game. I typed that. And then I put in parentheses, it was evident right away that the field conditions were going to be an issue. But then the next series came along, and Sammy Watkins catches that 36-yard slant and runs across the field as if it's a track surface. And so yeah. I went and deleted the note and just said, light, snowy conditions. I don't think it did become an issue. I don't know what got into Marlon Mack on that first play. But it wasn't an issue. The Chiefs did everything that they normally do. And by the way, having Sammy Watkins back, that offense looks like it's got that much more juice now. He played very well. He looked fast.
The one thing I wondered about this game, and the Chiefs had obviously jumped out to such a good start, when Mahomes took the little knee injury, when he kind of was limping really heavily for a little bit, he did run for a touchdown after that, so I'm probably overrating this a bit, but I did kind of want to see the Colts go after him a little bit and make him move around and make him try to make one of those crazy plays. I really only remember them, aside from like the Kenny Moore slot blitzes, I really only remember one or two blitzes. One of them was on a third and long that forced Mahomes to throw hot. He didn't try and extend the play, and it ended up being a minimal gain, and they had to punt, but I wouldn't have minded seeing a little more than that from the Colts. I mean, it's stupid to say now, because obviously you wish they would have done a lot of stuff different, because they lost by a pretty significant margin. But I would have been curious to see Mahomes have to move around on that knee, which maybe it'll be fine. Maybe it was just a bruise or whatever it was, but he was limping pretty heavily.
Yeah, Chiefs O-line got the better of this matchup with the Colts D-line big time. Indy does not have any edge rushers, and that's been true all season. Mm-hmm. We thought it'd be a bigger deal. They've survived that remarkably, and some of it's because they scheme their pass rush. Those Kenny Moore slot blitzes have been a big deal. When they do that, they almost always do a stunt or twist inside of it. So you see the slot blitz coming, but then there are other defenders looping and crossing as well. It's a lot for an offense to process. Chiefs did a great job with that. The Colts pass rush was a zero factor in the game.
Yeah. And you made the point in your extra point column, which people can check out, sort of Mahomes Belichick 2 piece. But, Collinsworth had made the point, Mahomes was so good in structure with the sort of RPOs and the quick strike type stuff. It's one, such an advantage when you are winning. In structure constantly, a bit, your routes are working, the defense is being fooled every time. But two, I mean, quick strike, you don't get a ton of guys in your way anyway, but I mean, it was almost like you take the offensive line and the pass rush off the field and just have them play 7-on-7. This was just easy pitch and catch for the first portion of this game for Mahomes.
I love the way that sentence ended right there, by the way.
Yeah, the old the old urinate and catch. we will have – that wasn't pretty good. I will say one thing I do, I have no idea why this became my muscle memory. When I type Pittsburgh, when I type it, I always do P-I-S-S, and then I start typing the rest. And it's – I catch it now all the time, but when I worked at the paper in Hartford, I once let one slip through, and it wasn't good, because like UConn and Pitt were like basketball rivals, so of course a bunch of people wrote in like, you're talking smack, and it's like, no, I just my fingers don't work.
It's a Freudian smack talk. Since the can of worms is open. When we were kids, someone who was not a big basketball fan, but they didn't have to be to do this, they would call the Detroit Pistons the Detroit Piss Stains, and it took me a few years to get that out of my head. I saw the Pistons as Piss Stains, and it happened to be, remember when the Pistons had those aqua uniforms under Doug Collins, like the Grant Hill for?
The Grant Hill, yep.
Yeah, it happened to be during that time, for what that's worth. So when they went back to the familiar Pistons uniforms, they kind of became the Pistons again. But for those aqua uniform years, they were Piss Stains around my world, the crew I rolled with.
that's quite a crew. Oh, well, we'll have plenty on Chiefs and Patriots on the Thursday deep dive show, and hopefully Mahomes can get some more of that piss and catch stuff going. Let's look ahead for the Colts, though, before Andy loses it. we talked about early in the season. It's been a long weekend. So the Colts need basically just more talent on defense. And that's still the case, as well as the defense played, as we talked about. There's just no pass rush here. There might be a couple guys available on the market. It's a really rich draft for defensive front four talent. Not to mention they do have the second pick of the second round, which they picked up in the Jets straight up for Darnold last year. So they'll have some chances to improve here.
Be interesting if DeMarcus Lawrence somehow made it to the market, how much the Colts would throw at him, because I bet you Matt Eberflus wants DeMarcus Lawrence. He coached him in Dallas, so you know it's a scheme fit. They badly need an edge rusher. It'd be interesting to see. I mean, DeMarcus Lawrence might become the highest paid defensive player of all time if he reaches the market. Although, I guess I'd have to backtrack. It is a rich draft for edge rushers this year, though, too, so... We'll see.
I will say it's less rich for edge rushers as it is for interior guys.
Oh, is it? Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And what's also interesting, because of the seasons that Fletcher Cox had, and especially Aaron Donald, I think there's going to be a new value placed on interior pass rushers. Teams this year figured out, defenses, offenses learned it the hard way, that a really good interior pass rusher is more destructive than a really good edge rusher. And we can get into all the reasons why, but... The main one being they're closer to the ball inside. And there's probably 10 or 12 other important reasons. But I bet you because of what Aaron Donald did this year, and DeForest Buckner had a nice year, and Jaron Reed had double-digit sacks inside. A lot of D-tackles were really productive pass rushers this year. That position value, it's going to inflate.
Now it's going to be a very interesting offseason with some of these defensive line names potentially coming on the market. We'll see how it goes. We come to the thing of the week, Andy. Do you have a thing of the week ready to go?
You better start it, because I do not.
I'll start it. I'm coming around a little bit of Taysom Hill. I don't love it, but obviously he made the fake punt play, which kept their first scoring drive alive, and if you buy momentum, it was huge. But just the fact that they actually put points on the board at that point in the game, instead of punting away again, was huge. But I still don't think I love him throwing the ball, but he threw it got called back on a hold, but he threw just a frozen rope up the seam to Alvin Kamara there. And it was just kind of funny seeing that on a night where Drew Brees came up short on a couple of somewhat similar downfield throws. Seeing Hill sort of drop that one in very nicely was a little bit fun. It was interesting.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm going to just piggyback off of your thing of the week. I think I am slowly coming around on Taysom Hill as well, but I've got such a long way to come around that I'm still behind you. I have not been a fan of that Taysom Hill package this year, because if I'm a defense, I absolutely love seeing Drew Brees not playing quarterback. And Hill is like, oh, he does a lot of things, but he does none of them well. He looks like a bad blocker. He looks like a bad H-back. I don't think he's as good as his running numbers suggest. At least early on, he was not. He's gotten better. And let's give him credit there. To his credit, he's gotten better in a lot of areas, and throwing the ball is probably one of them. So I might be behind you on that one, but with you, Taysom Hill, I'm not. My mind is open. It's got a long ways to go, but it's starting to open, and it helps that he's better now than he was early in the season.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's going to be a wrap for this show. We will be previewing the conference championships and also talking a little more coaching carousel and taking plenty of questions on the Thursday deep dive show, so send those in. For now, thanks to researchers Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor for making it sound smart. Thank you to producer Shelby Royston and the guys at Cadence 13 to make it sound good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. To get our two shows, as well as the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer featuring Jenny Brentson and Connor Orr, plus the MMQB Gambling Podcast hosted by myself, Jimmy Traina, and Scott Gramling, just subscribe to the MMQB NFL Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, radio.com/10things, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers, and we will see you guys on Thursday morning.